not one who really does like intros and stuff. Like, I don't say hello, welcome. I actually pride myself on like never addressing my audience. Like, they're not with us here. Because I always find it weird. I had a hard time starting a podcast, like, because I tried to record an intro and I was like, hello, welcome to The East is a Podcast. But I was looking at a wall when I was doing it. Like, I was like 30 centimeters away from a wall. And I was like, who am I talking to? Like, what? Who's in this room with me? What's going on? So anyways, Joo Hyun, can you introduce yourself for people who might not know you and tell us what we're here to talk about today?
Thanks for having me on. Really great to be here with you. My name is Joo Hyun. I am an alleged writer, I guess. I know you through Twitter, I think mostly. Although I have, you know, since discovered your show and like really enjoy listening in. So it's really exciting to be here with you today. Yeah, sorry, you just kind of caught me flat-footed. I'm like very bad about talking about myself.
No, that's fine. You authored the greatest tweet of all time that could possibly like be the base of the foundation of like a course on Orientalism. that's how I know you. Was actually, I do know you through Twitter, like this entire podcast of mine. But you authored this amazing tweet, which I want to save until the end of this episode, because I want to actually say that as a bonus episode, because I really do mean it, that like it's actually a really like one sentence or like a sentence and a half, really excellent description of kind of the mechanics of Orientalism, like the different kind of psychological and sort of psychoanalytic kind of leaps and bounds that it requires. But we, to get us back onto track though, before we get there, we're here to talk about the Korea War and its kind of myriad complications, and at least through a kind of global lens. Like, I think what we had kind of talked about before was for you to kind of like take over and kind of do an introduction and kind of run through, which you've very kindly prepared, which is amazing for me personally, because I just like sit here and I learn. But also, After this, I want to sort of think about the kind of global implications since then, because, you know, famously, we'll probably talk, I mean, I'm sure this comes up in your essay, your very good essay in the New Inquiry from last year called Life During Wartime, which I'll link to. But essentially, like the kind of rippling effects of this war, this kind of intervention, this violent sort of, imperialist intervention into a country that we still kind of live with the consequences today. But why don't we kind of take it from there? Why don't we start with the kind of like prehistory of all this? Like, how did we get to the situation in terms of this business of the North and South Korea? I know those aren't the official names, but this is kind of like, our ignorance is so deep, at least I'm speaking in my own level, like our ignorance culturally is so deep, especially here, that most of us don't even refer to the DPRK as its real name. So maybe we can kind of just like jump into it and you kind of take us in, Professor.
Sure thing. Disclaimer, I am not a professor. Sure thing. I'll be a sansangnim, I guess, a teacher. I guess to kind of start us off, I think, you know, you're very correct in that there is a very deep lack of knowledge around anything related to Korea, which I think is like very related to existing structures of knowledge and like knowledge production around Asia in general, you know, i.e. like the actual existence of Orientalism as like an institutional, you know, like living, breathing thing. From that basis, I think, you know, it's really necessary to kind of like, as you said, start with the prehistory of what often, you know, like is told as something that just begins with the division of Korea in 1945, which of course is like a very significant event, you know, to be kind of obvious about it. But at the same time, you know, that's something that comes at the end of a very long process and a much longer encounter in which, you know, like Korea and really the region are being integrated into the imperialist system that's, you know, arising and kind of doing this all over the world at the same time as well. So I think, you know, what's most immediate to understanding Korea is that it was a colony of Japan from 1910 to 1945. And that's a part that often gets very abridged. I think that, you know, there's a tendency to, you know, when the opportunity arises to like talk about the truth around Korea, to kind of like go about it in a way where Korea is not really the subject of its own story, I guess. And, you know, it's like almost as if history is still like happening to Korea, like as an object or as a recipient, rather than, you know, like trying to tell a story of like a reality that is, also the result of, like, you know, what Koreans have done. All that to say, getting into colonialism is very important because that's understanding the class conditions, the social fabric, you know, like everything about Korean society that, you know, resulted in the changes that we see now. You know, Mao talks about internal characteristics being the cause of change, not external forces. Even though external forces can incite change, you know, the stone can become the egg can become a chicken, but the stone can never become a chicken. Really flubbed that line there, but
I like that.
Okay, enough pontificating. So, you know, to kind of like jump into it, as I said, in 1910, Korea is annexed by Japan, and at that point, it's not Japan's first colony. You know, Okinawa or Ryukyu and Taiwan, you know, preceded by a number of years. There's also a way to look at, you know, the annexation of Hokkaido, which happens, you know, much earlier as like really that sort of initial step. The colonial or semi-colonial relationship actually stretches back at least 50 years before that annexation in the beginning of the 20th century. And this is during a period when Japan and other Western powers are imposing unequal treaties on Korea in a way that was very similar to what they had just been doing in China, and like we're still like in the process of wrapping up. Now, before annexation in 1910, Japan had already fought two wars in Korea, one the Sino-Japanese War against the Qing Empire, and then against Tsarist Russia in the Russo-Japanese War. And both of those wars were not like exclusively fought in Korea, but you know, like Japan did send its forces into Korea like through the pretext of these wars. And the first one is crucial because, you know, it's about like really beating back like the remnants of the Sinocentric system in the 19th century. And then in 1905, it's about, you know, like finishing this contest that's going on between Tsarist Russia and a rising Imperial Japan. And, you know, as students of the Soviet Union would know, you know, that war also triggers the 1905 revolution in Russia itself, which like sets the stage for 1917. So lots of like dense world history just like all going on there at the same time.
Can I actually stop you for a second? Just a brief detour slightly. Not a detour, pause. The Korean sort of national identity formation, the linguistic heritage is interesting, right? Because the modern language is like the modern writing system is created fairly recently. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Not that recently, like from the 15th or 14th century, I believe.
Oh, okay.
I'm definitely losing Korean points. I'm like supposed to know that.
But it was like it was kind of like something set from above, right? Is that the impression? It was like kind of like a writing system created by somebody very high up in charge, possibly some kind of monarch. I don't know. Anyway,
yeah, it was issued by King Sejong the Great, who basically made that declaration during. Ooh, is that Joseon or Goryeo? I'm not sure. I forget which dynasty, but he, you know, made that declaration because before then, you know, Chinese script had been used for the writing system. And the idea was that by adopting an alphabet, this would create a more accessible form of script that would be easier for more people to learn. And the degree of success for that was very much, you know, affected by like the fact that feudalism was still a thing and right after that colonialism. But that is the origin of the Korean script. The language itself is often considered a language isolate. I'm not a linguist, so I can't really like judge the accuracy of that. There is a fair amount of you know, influence from the Chinese language, particularly through scripts. But you know, Korean does have like a lot of native like vocabulary and like grammatical structure that is really like a pretty solid base for what the modern language is today, from what I understand. I don't know a ton about that area either. But, you know, I think it does get into an important thing, which is that, you know, Korea has had more or less like its own independent societies going back for many millennia. And, you know, it's been united as a peninsula for really more than like 1,000 years, you know, with some periods of fracture like within that. So, you know, all that to say, like, this is a society with like a very, very old history, and like really the part that we're talking about that's, you know, like I guess more immediately relevant to the present is like really in some ways like kind of scraping the surface. Yeah, I appreciate you bringing that in.
It's one more question, sorry. But like, is so then is kind of Korean history kind of bifurcated between like colonial and pre-colonial histories, including Japan, and kind of like these encounters with the great powers? Or is this a constant thing throughout history, kind of repeated at different turns?
Wow, that's a hard question.
Sorry.
Yeah, so the background to this is that nationalism is a very important part of Korean political culture. I think that's a fair statement to say. And there are many ways that this nationalism finds expression. And sometimes, you know, like there's a tendency to narrate Korean history in a way where it's all about, you know, like we've been repressed and beaten down and like our history is like so bloody. And it is, you know, but like there's kind of a conflation or like a equivalency that's made in those instances between like the modern imperialism of, you know, say Japan and the United States, with like conflicts with like Chinese dynasties that happened like over 1,000 years ago, you know? And while like, right. I do think that like Korea does have a very bloody history. There has been a lot of conflict, a lot of foreign invasion, that like, it's important to understand each of those things, like in their own era, under their own conditions, I guess. So it's a conflation I avoid, but like, there is definitely like a very strong, way of talking about Korean history that, I have often found like adopts that framing.
Okay, great. All right. Now I promise you I'm going to shut up for the rest of this. Okay. Keep going. Sorry.
No, I love your questions. So, you know, like whenever something pops up, I'm happy to, you know, go off the path for a bit and like stand in the bushes. It's cool.
Cool.
Okay. So where was I? All right. We were talking about the Russo-Japanese War and basically Japan, you know, really securing its dominance in that region of Northeast Asia. Because, you know, it wasn't just Korea on the table. They were also like looking at Manchuria. It was Sakhalin, which is like an island that's off the coast of what's now like Far East Russia. The Kuril Islands, which, you know, like span from like the top of the Japanese archipelago, like all the way north, like towards like, I believe like the Bering Strait. I'm not 100% certain, but, you know, this is like a very like, there's all to say like the stakes are very high in this situation. And it's at the end of that conflict that, a deal is actually made between the U.S. and Japan called the Taft-Katsura Agreement, because, you know, it was made between William Taft and, you know, his counterpart. And in this agreement, they essentially decided that they would respect each other's, you know, like individual claims in the U.S. for the Philippines and Japan and Korea, and not like try to compete with one another or take it from the other for, you know, at least the time being. But I bring that in because I think it's important to understand what Japan is doing in this period in the context of like a rising global imperialism. And, you know, there's certain class forces within Japan, honestly, that have like decided to like go the route where like, you know, no, we're going to like try to be as much of like a modern capitalist nation as possible. And, you know, that necessarily means that, you know, we will acquire colonies. We will build up the super powerful military. You know, we'll centralize production in very like dictatorial and violent ways. And, you know, I think that context is important because it helps us see like the whole picture and helps us kind of like place what's happening in Korea as part of world history, which I think is what I was trying to get to earlier when I was just rambling in the beginning. Anyway, it's only after, you know, like defeating Russia and getting this assurance from the US that Japan then actually moves in to like really consolidate its control in Korea. First is by making it a protectorate in 1905, and then outright annexation happens 5 years later. So, you know, we can see that, you know, there's all this inter-imperialist rivalry happening. There are some things I left out, which happened, you know, much, much earlier in like the 19th century, like, you know, the single instances that like the British and French tried to like take Korea, because of course they did, you know, they were fucking everywhere. But that's the general background to the formal colonial period, which is the 35 years before 1945. And, you know, Korea as a colony of Japan is very important for a couple of reasons. The first is the geostrategic value, which is like kind of as like a foothold in Asia. Korea like then can be a launch pad for future Japanese invasions into China particularly, which will come in the next couple of decades. And then there's, of course, you know, the economic value, you know, like why else do you have colonies? And the foundation of that is rice, because Japan is industrializing at this time. They have a growing population. At the same time, they don't have a ton of farmland to feed that population. And during the early parts of Japanese industrialization, they were really dependent on Southeast Asia for rice, which meant that, you know, they were then dependent on the British and the French really And for things like oil, tin, rubber, all of which you need, you know, to undertake industrialization during this period, they also had to get from European colonies in Southeast Asia. So a lot of their expansion was about, you know, like gaining direct access to these resources so that their development wouldn't be hampered by needing to get it from someone else, basically. And, you know, with Korea, like rice was really the foundation of everything in terms of the immediate value it provided. And like everything was built off of that in a way. So, of course, when they come in, the first thing they do is they do a land survey. They figure out where everything is. They, you know, determine who the quote unquote owners of you know, all the parcels are. They seize pretty much all of the palace lands, which, and, you know, the palace or the monarchy was the largest landowner in Korea at the time. And then within a decade, this monopoly company in, you know, the fashion of like the East India Company that they've established called the Oriental Development Company, which is very much on the nose.
What?
Yeah.
But Korea is west of them.
It doesn't matter.
Orientalism is a way of thinking. It's true.
Yeah, basically.
And it's a relation. Yeah, no, it's a relation, right? Like mm-hmm. in this case, it's like obvious class and... I guess could be said ethnic relation too, right? Of like superiority of whatever, right? Are the Japanese obviously have racial dimension to this domination too, right? Like there is this overlay of racial supremacism.
I think that's accurate to say. I think that I'm not an expert on this topic by any means, and probably my biggest hurdle is, you know, I don't speak or read Japanese, but from what I understand, the exact way in which, you know, that racial ideology develops is like at once like very informed by what is happening at the same time in Europe with like the development of scientific racism, and also, you know, like kind of filtered and adapted through like the particular lens of, you know, like Japanese cultural values and things of that nature. So like it is definitely a present aspect, but, you know, Japan is very like flip-floppy with the way that it wields this, and that, like, you know, there is like definitely this undercurrent of like, you know, we are superior, like, you know, a lot of the way that they approach it, from, you know, what I understand, is that because Asians are like quote unquote the same race, you know, Japan like kind of has like a right as like sort of the elder or like superior aspect to, you know, like acculturate the junior or the lesser
people. It really adopted European thinking about itself and its neighbors.
Yeah,
like it's like, oh, I'm Germany. I'm the leader of Europe. Like,
basically, yeah. So, you know, like in their own particular way, you know, with their history and like the existing society at the time. But you know, like all of that ideological aspect is founded on like the material domination, like the material expropriation of like labor and land and like all these things, right?
And Japan is a far more advanced capitalist society at this point, right? Like by leaps and bounds compared to Korea.
Yeah, for sure. Because its Meiji Revolution is, you know, in the mid-19th century, and then we're talking by the 20th. So, you know, this has already been like over 50 years of like undergoing that process for them. And now it's about, you know, like really being able to like get a hold of everything it needs to, both in terms of like raw materials, but also like opportunities for capital expansion. To be able to sustain that cycle, right? And, you know, Korea is a very important part of that, like in part because it is like Japan's biggest colony at this point. So as we were saying, the Oriental Development Company, as an example of that, you know, like within 10 years of annexation, owned about a third of like all the farmland in Korea. And by 1945, at least in the south, they had between 70 to 80% of all of the different rice lands. On top of that, you know, the Japanese, they seized the forests, the rivers, the mines, the fish stocks, lots of things that were previously either effectively held in common or just not subjected to capitalist property relationships. And all of that is in very deep collusion with the landlord class in particular, because, of course, and it's, you know, during this time that rents run as high as like 50 to 70% of what peasants grow, basically, because, you know, they're not. This isn't like a really cash-rich economy. Everyone is, you know, really like doing things like based on the actual commodity itself. And so, you know, basically the peasants are growing rice to feed themselves in order to live. And then like the government is coming in and taking like up to more than half of that. And then on top of that, of course, you know, landlords are like deferring taxes they're supposed to be paying onto the peasants who are renting the land from them. And what you end up with over time is a really regimented system of agriculture that is so deep-reaching that by the 1930s, farmers are being given grids of their own land and basically being told what seeds to plant almost like down to the square foot. And then they're given schedules in terms of like, this is when you fertilize, this is when you weed, this is when you harvest, you know, all of those things. And of course, all of the fertilizers and means of production that they need are being produced in Japan, and they have to buy them even if that puts them into debt. You know, it's by the 30s that like something like 75% of all of the peasants are tenant farmers that are working less than about like 2.5 acres, which, you know, when you are part of like a rural family with possibly like lots and lots of children, like multiple generations, is probably not going to be enough to like feed all of you, especially if, you know, on top of that, so much of what you produce is being expropriated away. And it's also during this time of like regimentation, agricultural centralization, that like over 1,000 different cultivars of Korean rice go extinct because, you know, they're pushing these monocropping strategies. Peasant fortunes in general get tied to the boom bust market economy. You know, rice becomes too expensive for a lot of people to eat, even though they're growing it. And there's mass displacement from the land because people are being driven into debt and starvation. It's during Japanese colonialism, 1 in 7 Koreans actually emigrated out, and they either mostly went to Manchuria and essentially reproduced village life there to a degree, or they went to Japan as kind of a migrant proletariat that lived in segregated quarters within urban settings that were kind of like social science language, I guess, or just nonprofit language, over-policed and like underserviced. So that's the general picture. And it's really after World War II begins, which in Asia, you know, we said it like the 1937 invasion of China generally, that things start to get a lot worse. And really throughout the 30s in general, because before that, there's the invasion of Manchuria in 1931. Japan is more heavily industrializing Korea, particularly in the north, because they need the cheap labor to keep the war machine going. But they're very careful to make sure that Korea is not able to produce finished products without Japan. They are implementing a direct rice collection policy on top of, you know, like their existing sort of like rent system and tax system that was going to landlords. There's the colonial rule in general just becomes much more violent because in order to enforce all of this, that means that you need more police and you need more interactions with law enforcement. There's mass conscription of Korean soldiers and laborers. About 600,000 people are shipped to Japan as forced workers. Over 100,000 people are conscripted into the Imperial Army. And what's become known as the comfort women system involves 200,000 women or so being more or less kidnapped or coerced through other means to be placed into a system of what most scholars agree is a system of sexual slavery that served Japanese soldiers throughout the empire. This didn't exclusively involve Korean women. It did involve women from all over Japan's so-called Greater East Asia co-prosperity sphere, which kind of brings back those racial and racialized dimensions that we were talking about earlier. But Korea does provide a really significant amount of, doesn't really provide, but rather it's that Japan takes a significant amount of the women who are involved in the system from Korea. So those are like kind of the big things that were going on at this time. Related to kind of those racial dimensions we spoke about, one big thing that was promoted was this concept of naisen itai, which is the idea of Korea and Japan as one body. That was kind of like a little bit like, you know, colorblind racism or like, you know, liberal multiculturalism that we have today, and that it was about like saying, oh no, you know, there's no difference between us. You know, like we're united, we're just the same, but also you have to like do everything the Japanese way. And then so it's during this war period that, you know, measures are taken such as banning the Korean language in public places, or, you know, like ensuring that it's, the script isn't being taught in schools. There's, you know, bans on like literature in the Korean script in general. A lot of intellectuals are persecuted for that around this time. And on top of that, there's a measure that's also taken for Koreans to register with Japanese names. So, you know, they have to like give up their entire identity essentially. And the society was organized in a way where like every 10 household was like put together into like a patriotic sort of association. You know, the function of these was essentially for people to spy on each other, but it was also through that, you know, they ensured things that like every day at noon, everyone was supposed to take like a 1 minute moment of silence for, you know, all of the brave soldiers who were dying for the empire. You know, at sunrise every day, you were supposed to come together and, you know, bow towards the emperor in kind of like recognition of his his divinity or whatever it was.
Fucking hell, man.
Yeah. So, you know, like nationalism, as I said, is very important to contemporary political Korean political culture because of this experience, basically, because like the oppression under colonialism is both like material and class-based and about production, but it's also like occurring like at this very deep psychological level as well, and like very much about like attacking just really the concept of like the Korean people as like existing, while on top of that destroying our land, our resources, our bodies, our families, you know, our villages, our society, right? So all of that is very important background. But what's also especially important is the kinds of resistance that developed during this period, because that's what's really going to shape the way that the politics play out, I think, following liberation. Now, some U.S. left historians, particularly Bruce Cummings, who I generally agree with on many, many things, tend to place the origins of the Korean War like in the 1930s. They're specifically kind of like looking at basically the armed resistance that Koreans were undertaking in Manchuria around that time. I think that's actually kind of a late reading in a way, because we can see resistance to colonialism developing in cycles for decades prior to that. In the 19th century itself, peasant uprisings were very common, even before like this imperialist kind of encroachment into Korea began in like a very strong way. In 1894, what's probably most important is the Tongak Revolution, which was this massive uprising of peasants who were seeking to both overthrow the feudal system of like the landlords and the aristocracy, and also kick out all the foreign imperialists. And it was actually this uprising that was a major spark for the Sino-Japanese War. So, you know, this event ends up also like entirely reshaping the balance of forces in the region at a very critical time, because, you know, this is like really a very significant blow for Qing China at this time, but then also like a very important step for Japan, because as a result of the Sino-Japanese War, I think they get an indemnity in silver that is like worth like what they would make in their entire economy in like 6 or 7 years. So, you know, all of that ends up getting invested into the military, and that really like paves their rise. But anyway, after Korea became a Japanese protectorate in 1905, there was another period of armed rebellions that broke out and lasted for almost 13 years. And it was mostly small pockets of people taking arms against the colonizers. But at some points, you ended up with some really big armies. And in 1907, in particular, a group of 10,000 people almost recaptured Seoul, as an example, which, you know, had that happened, would have like completely shifted the way that things developed over time. As I said, it's the resistance is coming in cycles. It's intensifying at some points, at others it cools off. But I think, you know, one thing to note is that, you know, it's very fractured as well by geography, by class interests, and of course, you know, by time, as, you know, rebellions and insurrections break out like in like a very concentrated period, and things die back, and, you know, new generations come and go. But, you know, what you end up with is this very kind of mosaic situation where people are very divided according to ideology and their particular class. On one hand, you have a lot of like pseudo-bourgeois, ex-aristocrat sort of elements that are pushing for national independence, but they're also usually very tied up with capitalist ideology. Some of them are just liberals and, you know, are mostly just like approaching things from that perspective. But
that's enough said about liberals. That describes them. Some are just liberals. Let's move on. You know what that involves.
Basically, yeah. But on the other hand, you have a few people who, you know, are actually pretty racist, to be honest. And I say that because they've absorbed like modern ideas in circulation at the time, like social Darwinism. I should have gotten the name of this person before I came, but in 1919, there was a major uprising throughout Korea known as the Samil movement. It was like a nonviolent, you know, mass mobilization. And nonviolence was supposed to be like at the ideological core of this. And it's a very interesting event because it ends up actually inspiring both the May 4th movement in China, which is connected to the Communist Party, and also like some of the political ideas of like Gandhi and Nehru, which is like just really interesting to think about when you think about kind of the way that political nonviolence has like this huge life kind of like in the world that is like much bigger than Korea in a lot of ways. But, you know, this is also like a very important early moment for that development, I think. In any case,
this is known in English as the March 1st movement.
March 1st movement.
It's like a human rights revolution. Like it's something that like Gene Sharp and company would endorse today. But it was 100 years ago. Not 100 years ago, but actually more than 100 years ago. That's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, it was over 100 years ago. It's interesting because, it like precedes so many of those things. And like their fundamental strategy was actually to like basically try to, well, like not the people in the streets, but like a lot of the kind of like bourgeois leadership who were like sort of kind of providing like the ideological like furnishings to like go along with all of this was, you know, they were saying like, oh, you know, like we're going to appeal to the world and like especially try to take advantage of the Paris Peace Conference that's happening now that World War One is over, because, you know, Woodrow Wilson said that self-determination is important. Woodrow Wilson didn't really say that. And also like Koreans weren't the only ones to like kind of, or, you know, these particular Koreans weren't the only ones to like make that mistake with, you know, the end of World War One, thinking that that would mean that, you know, colonies would be set free. Anyway, going back to the to some of the bourgeois elements in the resistance that were a little racist, the point I was trying to make was that one of the leaders of this this movement like had some ideas related to social Darwinism, where, you know, he didn't really see like ending colonialism as like, oh, we're gonna like become a liberated people, and like this is about like, you know, human freedom or like other high-minded ideals. Like his idea was basically like, we should throw off Japan so that we can become like the eminent global power, basically, and subjugate all of the world's peoples. So I bring this up because I think it's demonstrative of how, like, you know, this nationalism can have different class characteristics, and depending on its different class characteristics, it can either take on like a very revolutionary path, or it can go down a very reactionary path. And I think that's just a good example of that, that split. So, you know, besides all of that, you have the more important mass resistance, in my opinion, which is, you know, coming from the workers, mostly from peasants who are the dominant force in society, and from the student movements. But these are also fractured very much by geography and very much by, you know, where people are located as well. And what I mean by that is that, you know, you have a bunch of Korean workers in Japan who are organizing as workers there and like, you know, undertaking strikes and things of that nature. At the same time, you have this armed resistance that's going on in Manchuria that, you know, has actually this like very long history, like going back to like even like before annexation had been fully completed. And, you know, it's during, and, you know, it's in Manchuria that, you know, a lot of like various like Korean experiments and like anti-imperialism are undertaken. There was like a 2-year period where like a very large anarchist commune existed, and then it was crushed by Japan with, you know, the invasion of Manchuria. And then, you know, after that, there's a lot of collaboration between Koreans and the Chinese Communist and the Communist Party of China. And, you know, in some of these northeastern regions, you actually have situations where Koreans are forming the predominant force within, you know, the Communist Party of China. And in the Northeast anti-Japanese army in particular, Koreans are a very important force. And one person in particular, Kim Il-sung, really rises up, you know, through that experience. And, you know, actually by 1940 is the last commander left standing out of, you know, all of these different military leaders who had participated in that struggle. And then within Korea itself, you know, you do have a communist movement, you have independent peasant organized unions with connections to communists and also to like more, you know, right-wing nationalists as well. But because of, you know, the really intense level of repression within Korea, there's not really an ability to like come together in a united front within the country. And also outside of the country, everyone is fighting their own battles in their own different terrains. So that's kind of all of the background. And, you know, I want to get into the partition, but I've also been talking for a long time. So, you know, if you have any questions or there's anything I should clarify on, I'm happy to do it.
That thing about Kim Il-sung being the kind of surviving kind of figure, all that, that's, I mean, I'm beginning to understand the kind of heroic nationalist story that surrounds this family, because that actually is heroic nationalism, like rising up. And like, I mean, it makes sense now. I mean, more to me, obviously it made sense before, but yeah, this entire 20th century has been this weird story of tensions between Korea and the outside world, which has intense obsession with it and dominating it. So I just kind of ruined the thesis of the episode probably, but it's,
no.
But like, it's no, but I mean, it's so fascinating to think of like having to fight off like all these different kinds of invaders essentially, and mm-hmm. how that can create a kind of national legend around some people for good reason.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that with Kim Il-sung in particular, like there's been a very concerted propaganda campaign kind of from the beginning because like he is who he is. And like we know that because like there is attestation to it, like from other sources, you know, particularly from Japanese sources. Like they were obsessed with this guy because he was like, he was almost like a Robin Hood figure, you know, like he would do things like stage incursions into towns that were technically in Korea and, you know, like take over the town like very briefly and then, you know, like kind of like melt back into the wilderness. And that was like a very serious threat to Japan at the time, particularly when, you know, they're trying to fight, you know, this great Pacific war that's involving them on multiple fronts. But yeah, you know, like they've tried to say that like Kim Il-sung is like a pretender or things like that. But there's definitely a firm historical, it's undeniable like who he actually was. I think that's a very important element to like understand in terms of like the power and the importance that a figure like that has, you know, in a society like colonial Korea, where, you know, there is so much resistance, but there's also a lot of hurdles to like bringing it together in a really concentrated way to like, know that, you know, like someone is, you know, undertaking such heroism within their own context.
So this is like Fidel before Fidel. Like, that's crazy.
A little bit. You know, Fidel had a little more, was able to, you know, like win the conflict through to the end. Kim Il-sung, you know, like a lot of things just stacked against his favor. And also, you know, he was not the only one, you know, like undertaking this. There was actually like another group of Koreans that were like mostly based out of Yunnan and were more closely like, you know, with the CPC in a lot of their struggles.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So, you know, there's a lot of different like pockets of this. And like, he's one of like many actors who are fighting this own like Korean war against colonialism, which, you know, is often like not very discussed. That's, you know, happening on multiple fronts with like multiple forces. Yeah, it's a very particular history for sure.
Okay, yeah, let's just keep going.
Yeah, okay. Partition. So let's set the stage. August 10th, 1945. This is one day after the US has destroyed Nagasaki with an atom bomb. And it's also the day after Soviets simultaneously reach Korea. So a Pentagon committee is tasked with finding a dividing line for U.S. and Soviet occupation forces. Two colonels, one of them is Dean Rusk, who will later be Secretary of State for JFK and Lyndon B. Johnson. Really terrible dude. This group of Pentagon guys, they choose the 38th parallel because that'll mean that Seoul will be in the U.S. zone. What they don't realize is that that's actually the same line that Japan once proposed to Tsar Nicholas II for a similar kind of arrangement.
Imperialists have one brain.
Yeah, exactly. Now, the how and why of why this decision is made is that Japan has not even officially surrendered yet. I think that's important to note. But the Soviets are charging through Manchuria and they've already reached Korea. So I think a lot of the same foothold logic that, you know, Japan kind of displayed of like, oh, we need like this one little corner of Asia for when we're like, you know, we one day in the future own the entire thing, is like still very much like in play here. Another thing to note is that in terms of the how, this is a unilateral decision being made by the US. And I think that's very important to stress. Koreans have not been asked anything about this, but Korea itself had previously been discussed at the Yalta and Tehran conferences. And FDR had actually proposed a trusteeship arrangement, but no one had agreed to it in the sense of saying like, yes, let's do that. According to Bruce Cummings, Stalin didn't quite disagree with the trusteeship, but he said it would be short, but the matter wasn't like formally settled. And it's interestingly missing, you know, from some of the other written agreements that came out of Yalta. One thing to note is that, you know, Korea kind of like presented a problem because, you know, it's not covered in Yalta. The US, Soviets, and Chiang Kai-shek have already previously released a statement in 1943 saying that Korea should be free and independent. With the caveat that it should be so, quote, in due course. But because things haven't been formally settled, you know, like what's going to happen with Korea is kind of a wild card. So the US is moving to both halt the Soviet advance, keep their foothold, and kind of like, you know, hope for the best and like, you know, put forward their sort of solution to this, which, you know, of course is going to favor them, but, you know, like in the hopes so that, you know, it won't get too much pushback. So the way that they inform the Soviets is that they don't actually direct anything to them. They put these details into General Order 1, which is the document that's addressed to Japan and lays out the terms of surrender that are expected. And then the Soviet Union is just basically sent a copy of that telegram. So they receive this message that's not addressed to them, that contains this detail about, like, you know, this is how Korea is going to be divided. So in responding in that communications context, Stalin says, you know, I have nothing against the substance of this order. He does, like, put in two requests for, like, other things, not like where the dividing line will be in Korea. But I want to tell that story in this way because, like, when it gets narrated rather quickly, people tend to say, like, oh, the US and the Soviet Union divided Korea, as if, like, they sat down together and, like, fought over which line it was going to be. And, like, you know, I'd both agree that that was going to be the thing to do, right? I think when we look at what happened, we can see, no, the US divided Korea, and, like, the Soviet Union may have acquiesced to it. You know, we can, like, debate as to whether, like, those reasons were justified. But I do think that, like, actually talking about the sequence of events here is important for that reason, because it really illuminates the kinds of motivations that are driving either country's involvement in Korea. And I think that's going to very deeply shape both the outcomes on either side of division and also the ultimate result that, you know, we now have a partition that has lasted for, at this point, like, almost 80 years since we're coming up on 2022, I guess. So yeah, that's kind of the formal context in which everything happens. Notice, you know, no Korean faction is part of any of these decisions. These shots are being called for Korea, but Koreans, of course, have plans of their own. When the emperor announces his surrender via radio on August 15th, that's a very big day. It's commemorated in, you know, both the DPRK and ROK today as Liberation Day. And there's huge celebrations all over the country. People are ready to decolonize. In some cases, they're going ahead and seizing Japanese-controlled lands by themselves. They're attacking colonial officials in some places. The USSR is only in the north. US doesn't reach the south for another 3 weeks, actually. And in that period, you know, they kind of ask, like, Japan to, like, sort of, like, you know, hold that for us, I guess. But, you know, like, Japan is not really in that much of a position to do this. And in the meantime, the Koreans are organizing themselves. One of the more kind of, like, liberal resistance elements I mentioned earlier, or I didn't mention him, but that's kind of where he comes from. His name is Yeon Hyung. He puts together a committee for a preparation of Korean independence. And what this committee does is they basically put out the call for the people to, like, basically come together in their own self-governing organs, which come to be known as the People's Committees. And there are hundreds of these established all over the peninsula within weeks. And, you know, they're a varying kind of composition. Like, you know, this is a very, like, hurried process. In a lot of cases, it's just like, oh, this is, like, our village elder or someone who's very respected in our community. So, you know, this person is going to lead our people's committee. But, you know, in some other cases, you know, you have people, like, doing things like trying out elections and stuff like that. In any case, within just a couple of weeks, they're ready to declare the creation of some kind of provisional state. So on September 6th, they announced the creation of the People's Republic of Korea. 2 days later, the U.S. finally arrives. And they're under the command of Lieutenant General John Hodge, acting under orders from Douglas MacArthur, who will then go on to, you know, quite infamously, command the early portions of the Korean War. And when the U.S. military arrives, they basically decide that they're not going to recognize the People's Republic of Korea. They don't recognize the People's Committees. They basically brand them as, like, communist or subversive elements, and they move to disband them quite violently. Although some of them do hold out for years in a couple of places where U.S. authority is a bit weaker. Now, you know, given how they're coming in by basically, like, overturning the beginnings of, like, a new Korean sovereignty, the way that they establish control in Korea is by essentially absorbing the Japanese colonial bureaucracy. A lot of the same people who were, you know, were working within Japanese colonial organs are just kind of brought back into the same roles. They quite literally take over the building that the Japanese colonial government was based out of, and, you know, base their operations out of that.
Well, they're not subtle.
Yeah, they're not subtle at all. They just literally, like, take down the Japanese flag, raise the American one. They even declare that English is going to be, like, the official language of government, and they just proceed. They retain about 9,000 Korean police officers that were left over from Japanese rule, and then they hire 15,000 more, which means that they end up with more police than there were during colonialism within a smaller land area, because their occupation zone is only in the south. The cops are, like, how they govern. These guys bust unions, they enforce prohibitions on strikes, and they also play, like, a huge role in actually helping with the not even the establishment, like sort of the takeover of the existing militarized sex industry that was in Korea at the time from the Japanese, and kind of readapting it for the US occupation. And, you know, that involves like cops doing things like basically like giving families choices of like, oh, well, you know, like you don't have your taxes, or, you know, you're late on like this kind of bride that I expect. So, you know, I can either do this, or, you know, you like, you can give me like one of your family or something like that. And in some cases, just like outright kidnapping. So a lot of the colonial violence, or not even a lot of, all of the colonial violence of Japanese rule is continuing with the same people. And in many ways, there's even less restraint in this initial period because, you know, there is confusion. Like the U.S. is trying to establish itself. And on the other hand, you know, the U.S. is actually like, by like sweeping away, you know, like a lot of the existing regulations and things like that the Japanese had in place, not that, you know, those were like any kinds of wonderful things, but like kind of by, I guess, creating that bureaucratic chaos with this transition, you know, like the U.S. is like creating the conditions for, and in many cases, like directly encouraging, you know, these kinds of activities to continue.
But they were kind of belated their arrival into Korea, right? It's kind of like the story and over and over again in America. It's not, I don't know if it's a matter of underestimation or their forces were too stretched out, but I mean, we'll probably get into this when we're talking about the war.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, I think it was a fair amount of like them being like very stretched out. And also they had to occupy Japan at the same time. That was the other thing.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. But, you know, like when they do come in, they come in quite violently. And Hodge actually moves to create an army for South Korea on his own against orders from Washington, from what I understand. And he basically creates special schools for retraining Korean officers who had served under the Japanese. And these aren't like regular grunts. These are like people who made a career of being in the Japanese Imperial Army. These are imperialists as far as I'm concerned. And in a lot of cases, it's the same people who were fighting against people like Kim Il-sung, especially in Manchuria. Park Chung-hee, who later became sort of like military dictator president of South Korea, himself actually was an officer in Manchuria during this period.
So these were like Contras.
Yeah, these were like Contras. You know, this was like kind of a, I'm pretty sure this was before School of the Americas. It's like, you know, like very like, it very much echoes what happens, you know, like later throughout the world. And, you know, like, I think the cases you brought up, like, you know, Mossadegh and like, and Arbenz and stuff, like, you know, they're within the same decade, but like what's happening in Korea is like happening like just a few years earlier. So in a lot of ways, like a lot of these things are like not being tested out for the first time, but they are like kind of like being brought from like the US's like own history of like, you know, genocidal wars, like within its own territory and like throughout Latin America, and then kind of like remixing that into like the new post-war kind of situation that's been created. As I said, US is like very nakedly ruling through violence. I think one important thing to note is that if in the South, the basis of governance is essentially the previous colonial structure, in the North, it's the people's committees that becomes the basis for future governance. And, you know, we see that in that, you know, it's the people themselves that are really carrying out and also demanding a lot of the policies that arise within these first few years. There is a provisional people's committee that's established at the national level to coordinate, you know, amongst all the various localities. And, you know, because the original people's committees were put together in such a rushed way, like within a couple of years, they're actually holding Korea's first elections, which, you know, operate by principles of secret ballot, one person, one vote, universal suffrage. And there's even U.S. Army testimony about that, which, you know, I'm happy to provide if needed, just to kind of demonstrate like that, you know, this did indeed happen for, yeah, you know, and then from that process, there's immediately a move to implement the kinds of reforms that are really meant to liberate the Korean people from colonialism and decolonize in a material way, you know, like not in like this kind of like highfalutin sort of imaginary, like whatever sense that's, you know, kind of popular amongst some of popular culture right now, but like really like in its original meaning, right, to like undo colonization. So that means that they're nationalizing industries. There's a land reform that's undertaken and completed within 25 days, which is incredible, and involves giving back over 2 million acres to people. There is a massive literacy campaign. There's 12,000 schools built all over the country within 3 years. By 1948, 92% of the population is literate, from a previous position where 80% of people didn't have formal schooling and 90% of the women couldn't read. There's equal rights and equal pay for women established within, I believe, the first year, paid maternity leave, nursing breaks, all these things that are not in the current infrastructure bill in Congress. And aside from the People's Committees, the way the society is being governed is through mass organizations. You know, there's women's org. There's a women's org that, you know, is designed to get women involved in civic life and like kind of bring them out from like the traditional restrictions to more domestic spheres. There's peasant orgs that are put together where, you know, the peasants are collectively managing agricultural policy in the countryside. There's youth leagues, which Korea being a slightly different society than, you know, in the West, like youth is defined to, I guess, a bit older than what people would call youth in America. I believe it's 40 years old. And, you know, as a result of like all of this direct participation, you know, like party membership is also swelling. And the Workers' Party itself was actually slowly put together over this time by the unions of multiple parties, some of which were not, you know, originally Marxist-Leninist in outlook. So really what's happening is that a mass society is being created in the North, you know, based on these popular people's committees. And the party is also becoming a mass party in that process. Whereas in the South, you know, like you have this very brutal kind of governance that's happening. And, you know, really a lot of increasing opposition and dissatisfaction with, you know, U.S. rule and also what is going on in terms of the division. Because like I said, you know, when this original line is drawn, there's not really a plan, right? Like the Soviets get there first, the U.S. kind of like swings in, like make sure that they kind of like set up their zone. And, you know, they're supposed to be establishing a trusteeship, but because the details of that haven't been discussed, they have to first agree to come together to discuss the details of the thing that they're going to do. and, you know, that takes them months. You know, it's not until the end of 1945 that they put together a joint commission. And, you know, trusteeship is widely opposed by most Korean people. I think it's very important to note that this is not a popular idea. But, you know, like, again, like the Soviets and the U.S. are kind of like coming together to try to make it happen. Over about like 2 years of going back and forth, they just can't see eye to eye. And finally, the U.S. decides, you know what, fuck it. We're going to hold our own elections in the South. And these are going to magically apply to the entire territory. Which is just like fundamentally not an election. Yeah. Yeah, like I don't care if you believe in dictatorship or proletariat, you know, like whatever, like you have to look at that and realize like that is not democracy, period. You know? Like there's no way to defend that. And you know, the people know this. It's a widely boycotted election, actually. Pretty much the only person who runs is Lee Seung-man, who ends up as president. And Lee Seung-man is like this longtime independence activist who like actually spent the last 30 years before coming back to Korea in 1945 on a US military plane living in the United States. You know, like he has a PhD from Princeton, you know, like he does have a little bit of like a resume in terms of like participating in the independence struggle, but like he was not in the thick of it in terms of like what people were going through in Japan or Manchuria within Korea itself, or even in Shanghai, where like the provisional government was supposed to be based out of, which, you know, he did participate in like various degrees with, you know, when it was around. But all to say, you know, like he's this very right-wing anti-communist nationalist, and he's very much aligned himself with the US military. And that really speaks to the kind of power arrangement that's being created in the South, because, you know, you can't just rule through violence, right? You have to get some kind of buy-in from the local population. And the way the US is doing that primarily is, you know, by basically getting the bourgeois and landlord interest aligned behind it and like, you know, really building up like, and, you know, allowing this anti-communist fervor to like fester, which, you know, is represented in both Lee Seung-man and like kind of his political maneuvering, but also, you know, in the apparatus of the state itself, right? In the police and the military, and also in these fascist vigilante, like right-wing groups that like get organized, a lot of whom are actually like the landlords and the sons of the landlords who are coming down from the North after the land reform. And like, you know, they're just pissed, right? And so like they're forming like these kind of like brown shirts, I guess, is that the term from Italy or something? Yeah, they're basically forming these brown shirt organizations, backing up both the US and, you know, the ROK once it's formed, you know, through this sham election. And of course, people are fighting back to this as well. You know, there's already been a major rebellion against the US in 1946. In 1948, two more break out. One of them is in Jeju, and which is an island off the south coast. And, you know, the election is a major reason for this uprising, in addition to like continued landlord exploitation on the island, as well as, you know, police repression and killings of people. And the US just responds with like absolute total war. You know, they bring in the new ROK military, they bring in the police, you know, they bring in these fascist gangs, basically, these brown shirts, and then they just go on a killing spree throughout the island. They like declare martial law and like establish an order where anyone found more than 5 kilometers inland will be shot on the spot, and everyone is forced to move out into the coastal areas. And so, you know, any villages they find still in the interior, they burn to the ground. And, you know, over half of Jeju's villages are burned during this process. And by the end of it, something like 20% of the island's population, something like 60,000 people are dead. And, you know, related to this, there's another mutiny that breaks out in some of the southern cities in Yeosu and Suncheon. And these are actually soldiers who are refusing to be deployed to Jeju. And, you know, they basically end up like taking control of their own unit and like fighting back and like kind of establishing this like guerrilla insurgency in the south that lasts in southern Korea until something like 1957. So like, you know, even like beyond, you know, when the armistice is being signed that, you know, supposedly like, well, actually doesn't end the Korean War in 1953. So yeah, that's more or less the story of like how partition happened. And, you know, of course, after that is the war itself. But I realize, you know, it's a very complicated story. And I think that's part of the difficulty of this in that, you know, most people are not very familiar with Korea. I think, you know, a lot of people, it's fair to say in the English speaking world also like don't have a lot of like familiarity with just East Asia, like, you know, in terms of history. And so, you know, it is very difficult to like for someone to wrap their head around. But I hope that, you know, filling out all these details does make it a little bit more easy to grasp.
No, that was really good. And it's just, it seems like from what I'm hearing and like kind of what I've been looking at in preparation of this is that like, this is a lot of the facets, a lot of the things that we'll see in terms of regime change wars, dirty wars, the acts and a series of kind of escalations to the point where the U.S. had to begin a large scale military operation against communist troops that were basically about to conquer the entire island or peninsula. Like they were about to have victory, and it was only until like the last minute intervention of the U.S. that this supposedly civil war turned into, you know, what we know today. I mean, even then, this is what I learned today on these, I watched these really dorky, but like kind of informative. I mean, you have to look past the kind of like chauvinist Western goggles that they see everything through, but like their nerdiness kind of trumps their ideological work. So they treat it like a video game or whatever. Like you can kind of tell that they made animations and they just explain it to you. And you see the dramatic shifts over the course of this war between one side has like 90% of the terrain and then gives it up. And then it suddenly finds itself like on its back. And of course there is the intervention of China. So it's like it turned into this almost like, I don't want to say it's not a proxy war because that cheapens a lot of things. People say proxy war, like people say, oh, Yemen is a proxy war, right, between Iran and whatever, which is like bullshit. No, Yemen, they're having a war and aggression in Yemen by the imperialists, and Yemen has allies, right? And so like this, I find the resonances today with all the sort of characters, right, like from, you know, slowly turning up the volume on your intervention from just kind of material support to the people you need to outright warfare that costs you tens of thousands of troops, right? And how this kind of runs the gamut of the logic of American and, you know, British imperialism too, but especially like at least the post-war variety that we know, right? Like this is the era of Alan Dulles and, you know, the great sort of acts. But I guess in the story of the Korean sort of the chapter of this story of like whatever, like modern encounter with imperialism across the world, like they couldn't get the total victory that they demanded. Mm. And this kind of country that remained really has proven to be a colossal pain in the ass geopolitically, strategically, right? And just over and over again proves its, I'm talking about the DPRK obviously, but like, but so anyways, maybe we should get into the actual war part now or whatever. I mean, we can, there's probably different ways to approach this, but what do you think, how do we best approach it? We'll be right back.
Thank you.